very good morning to everyone. The first case of the morning is number 04-1901, Keach against the U.S. Trust Company. Mr. Anderson?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm here representing the plaintiffs in this case, Deb Keach and Patty Sage, who were two of the more than 4,000 participants in the Foster and Gallagher employee stock ownership plan. I'd like to address two fundamental questions with the court this morning. The first question being whether the defendant, U.S. Trust, breached its fiduciary duties to those plan participants under ERISA. And second, assuming that such a breach occurred, whether there is some reason why the plaintiffs are not entitled to a remedy on behalf of themselves and the rest of those former plan participants. Now, with respect to U.S. Trust's breach of its fiduciary duties, the district court committed legal error. And it did so by failing to apply the rules under ERISA with respect to prohibited transactions.
Mr. Anderson, I mean, as I understood the essence of your argument, it really was that, maybe I'm slightly oversimplifying, but in light of the limitations on the opinion from the Sun and Shine law firm, it cannot be said that U.S. Trust itself undertook the kind of good faith investigation into the 1995 transaction that it was obliged to do as a fiduciary. Because I don't see you contesting really that the price paid for these shares, given the information available at the time, was itself not a fair price. Is that correct?
It is correct, Your Honor, that given the district court's factual findings, we are not here claiming that the price was beyond some range of,
right,
of a fair market value.
And given the clear error standard, that would be awfully hard for you to do. But it does seem that the district court mentions a lot of indications in the record that U.S. Trust, in fact, did take a lot of steps to investigate this transaction, and that on the whole, it was a good faith investigation. That's subject to the clear error standard as well, is it not?
So far as it goes, it is, Your Honor. But what the district court found specifically with respect to the sweepstakes aspect of this, of the transaction, and the risks associated with these aggressive sweepstakes that Michigan Bulb Company, part of Foster and Gallagher, was running, we're not contending that there was error in the factual findings on that at all. The court, in fact, found that U.S. Trust didn't even know what these sweepstakes were. They didn't know what the components of the sweepstakes were. They didn't know how they worked. And that U.S. Trust, in conjunction with Sonnenschein, there was nothing from the record from which the district court could conclude that they investigated these risks at all. So it may be true, and we're not contesting, that U.S. Trust did a lot of stuff in connection with this transaction, but with respect to the sweepstakes themselves and the risks associated with running sweepstakes that the company had been told, laws of at least 9 states could be read to outlaw them. If you look at the statutes of those states, Your Honor, I think I submit that it's quite clear that they were violating those statutes.
Well, I mean, but there are so many facts in the record. I mean, your position in a sense is that no one can be found to have conducted a good faith investigation, even if they didn't look into something that would not have made, that somehow had not percolated up to the level of importance. Obviously, with 20/20 hindsight, eventually these sweepstakes became problems. But the complaints that were coming in represented only something like 1% of the sales. It was a very small disturbance in the force, if you will, at that time, 1995.
Well, we're certainly not contending, Your Honor, that anybody should have predicted in 1995 that the entire company was going to come crashing down because of what happened in 1998. And I think if we had to prove that, that would be a difficult thing to prove. But
what
we don't.
What are you arguing then? Because, I mean, it seems to me if it was just a minor little problem that got resolved case by case, the investigation they did was enough to show that there wasn't anything big going on.
But the risk, Your Honor, was not limited to the risk that they would be forced to pay some fines to some states. The risk was that you're running these sweepstakes And if you read the laws of these states that say you can't have a sweepstakes where you tell somebody that they're a winner if everybody that gets the sweepstakes wins the same prize, you just can't do that. And it's clear from the record that that's what Michigan Bulb was doing. That was one very important aspect of their sweepstakes. Now, one of the risks of doing that is not that you're going to get fined by a state attorney general. The risk is that you ought to be running your business in compliance with the law, particularly if you're buying that business as a trustee for pension plan participants, and that if you change that sweepstakes to comply with the law, that is going to affect your response rates to the sweepstakes, it's going to affect your revenues, and it's going to affect your profits. And we know that that's true from the record, because 2 years later, in 1997, when Michigan Bulb Company did change its sweepstakes, stopped sending everybody wins into the states with the most strict laws on that subject, and made some other changes, they themselves projected that profits for the first 6 months of the following year were going to go down by $4 million. And I don't recall the exact number, but that was out of projected profits of about $20 to $30 million. So it was.
You are assuming that such an investigation would have yielded a legal opinion that these things were clearly illegal, and I don't know that that's maybe out on the horizon that was going to happen. Everybody did get these little packages of seeds and so forth, right?
As far as we know, that's right.
As far as we know, yeah. So everyone did win, as it were.
Well, what we do know from the record, Your Honor, is that NBC's sweepstakes lawyer had told them, one, that these laws could be read to prohibit that aspect of their sweepstakes, two, that those laws were not being enforced currently against their kind of company out of prosecutorial discretion, third, that if the states did begin enforcing their laws, not if they changed them, but if they started enforcing more aggressively, Michigan Bulb would have to make fundamental changes to its sweepstakes. What we also know is that even in hindsight, Mr. Derschlag, the great sweepstakes expert on behalf of U.S. Trust, was not willing to offer an opinion that Michigan Bulb was complying with those prize and gift laws. He was perfectly willing to say that they were complying with some other laws, that you can't have an illegal lottery, but even in 2020 hindsight, he was not willing to say that they were complying with those state laws. Now, our contention is that if U.S. Trust had conducted a prudent investigation, had even spoken to Mr. Auerdick, which they didn't do, or had spoken to an expert along the lines of Mr. Derschlag, they would have found out, oh, these laws could be read to prohibit what we're doing. I've read the laws myself. It looks, at best, borderline. And nobody is willing to give me an opinion that we're complying with the law. Now, our contention is that having found that out, no reasonable, prudent investor would be willing to conduct this transaction at the same price that they were willing to conduct it at without knowing all of that information. Now, you and I can disagree, Your Honor, over how clear it is from reading those statutes that they were violating them. My opinion is it's quite clear. But what is absolutely unmistakable from the record is that nobody was willing to tell them to the contrary, even in hindsight. Even when U.S.
And even other companies that knew about this, I take it the auditors did know about these things. I mean, all sorts of people looked at these at this transaction. It's a big transaction, after all.
And what the record discloses as to at least one of those other parties, the BA Securities that did the placement memorandum, is that they asked F&G and Michigan Bulb for things like significant risks, communications from regulatory authorities, and we're not told anything about sweepstakes and about these letters from the attorneys general. And there's nothing in the record to show that anybody else who looked at it was informed about the background of sweepstakes at that time or about the fact that Michigan Bulb was running this everybody wins sweepstakes and that at least nine states, and actually it's more than nine, had laws at that time that directly address that form of sweepstakes. And
well, in hindsight, as without foresight, what really happened was that somebody complained, got on TV, then the political types, attorney generals, decided there's blood in the water, and suddenly whatever had been passively accepted suddenly turned into a political issue, and that's when the sweepstakes became mud, I guess, and it all changed because they were doing very well even for a couple more years with these things.
That's correct, Your Honor. We're doing well, and the district court found that the signal event was in 1998 when this elderly gentleman went to Florida and the media started to get involved. You're absolutely right. And, again, our contention is, accepting for purposes of this appeal, that nobody in 1995 would have predicted that was going to happen, and therefore that direct mail sweepstakes were going to become non-viable, at least for the time being. What should have been foreseen in 1995 was that changing the sweepstakes to become fully compliant with the law, to, as U.S. Trust as Michigan Bald phrased it a couple of years later when they did change it, to stop sending everybody wins to states that prohibit it. That's their own language, and these are the same laws that were on the books in 1995. If NBC had looked ahead in 1995 and said, what will happen if we change our sweepstakes to comply with the law, the answer would have been profits will decline.
But Mr. Auerdick was reviewing everything they were doing. He never wrote them a letter up to and including 1995 that said, in my opinion, you must change this way of doing business because the legal risk is too big.
I think that's right.
Apparently he did reject other things they did. I can't recall the specifics of that, but I think that general statement is made.
Well, that's right. I think it's pretty clear from the record that what Mr. Auerdick was doing was disclosing that these were risks, that the laws could be read to prohibit these sweepstakes, and telling them that given the enforcement climate right now, not to put this too cavalierly, but it looks as if you can continue to get away with it for the time being. And our contention is that that's not good enough. If you are a prudent investor...
You think he was committing malpractice not to tell them to stop immediately since there was a violation of the law?
I don't have an opinion either way on that. I think he was covering himself by telling them that what the laws said and that if the enforcement practices changed, they could be forced to change what they were doing. But if you're a trustee on behalf of pension plan participants and you're buying this company, you might be able to continue getting away with it, just isn't good enough. A trustee should buy this company with the intention and the expectation that the company is going to comply with the law, not that the company is going to tiptoe along the borderline or across the borderline on the assumption or the gamble that they're going to continue to get away with it in the future.
I suppose it's one thing to say comply with the law and another to think of it as an interpretation of the law. I mean, did these sweepstakes laws cover situations like Michigan Bulb, where people actually were getting some things, however trivial they may have been, and where there was not apparently the kinds of abuses that Publishers Clearinghouse and the others were engaged in were not the kinds of things Michigan Bulb was in. In other words, you know, to the extent there's an interpretive aspect to it, it's not quite the black picture you're painting.
Well, Your Honor, the statutes that we've reproduced in the addendum to the brief, I think it's true of all of them, and it's certainly true of most of them, that they simply don't address the question of whether or not the recipient is actually getting the prize or not. The harm is that you are representing that these people have been specially selected, that they are winners, when in fact what you're really doing is just giving them a promotional prize that you're giving to everybody who responds to your sweepstakes. It's just not a question under those statutes whether you actually get the packet of seeds or not.
But that isn't what really took them under, as I understand it. There may have been some genuine fraud under the label sweepstakes that exposed everything, and then that sucked everything out, every other sweepstakes down the drain with it, didn't it?
In 1998, that's certainly the district court's view of what happened, and in view of clear error, not something that we're directly challenging here today.
So
again,
if we have that, though, then you end up with, technically these, you know, maybe walking the edge or whatever, but you're not, the attorney, Auerdick, didn't think there was anything fraudulent or anything else. It just was maybe tricky or marginal, but it wasn't one of those things that it was just outright illegal.
Well, Your Honor, again, the best I can answer to that is that when I read the statutes in the addendum, I think it was, mm-hmm. and obviously you'll all reach your own opinion on that. I see I should probably sit down at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. We'll hear now from Mr. Eccles.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. We've heard a shrinking theory of the case here. Now, the case was tried on the theory that U.S. Trust should have foreseen the ultimate demise of the company, but the district court very clearly said, as the court's questioning brought out, that that was principally caused by problems, bad publicity arising from American Family Publishers and Publishers Clearinghouse that dragged down everybody else who marketed through sweepstakes. As I now hear the theory, it's resting almost entirely on Exhibit 286, which is something prepared by John Auerdick in September of 1991. It's in the plaintiff's separate appendix at 75. And I hear two pieces to the theory now of the case. One is it's obvious that Mr. Auerdick was opining that Michigan Bulb was violating the laws with these Everybody Wins promotions in nine states, and that that is directly linked to a $4 million later projection of profits going down in the first half of 1998. Both of those propositions are based on a whole lot of disputed facts. The district court had this exhibit in front of it. It was referred to extensively in the testimony, and all the conclusions, the findings the court reached, reject each piece of this. Let me go over the main ones if I can.
But could I just ask you first, though, it seems to me what Mr. Anderson is saying is that in an environment in which U.S. Trust was not focusing or aware of the sweepstakes risk, it eventually came to this $19.50 per share price. Had this additional fact been added in, there would have been some further discount. For all I know, 5 cents a share. I mean, but you know, given that the risk didn't look all that big in 1995, but there was some risk, and so there would have been some discount, and we don't know what that discount would have been since the district court didn't focus on these things.
I think that's what he has to say, Your Honor, although I actually heard him say something slightly different, which is they're not contesting that the 1950 was outside the range
of fair
market
value. Well, I thought he qualified that, though, by saying it would still have been, without taking the sweepstakes stuff into account, but had anybody focused on the sweepstakes risk, if 1950 is the reasonable price absent the sweepstakes risk, and then we'll say, you know, it's a 5% extra discount or something, you know, anything, pick a number, but some kind of discount, because if you've got legal risk, then your shares may be worth a little less.
And as I said, I think he needs to have that proposition. However, the district court expressly found 1950 was not more than fair market value, and the evidence supported that overwhelmingly.
But isn't he saying, though, that the district court, in coming to that finding, failed to take into account the actual risk that existed because of the sweepstakes issues that were out there, the nine states or, you know, whatever?
I think he is, Your Honor, and I think that's reviewable for clear error. The district court considered all this evidence, and he had a lot of reasons why he would not reach the factual propositions that Mr. Anderson is asserting here. If you look at this Auerdick set of materials, Exhibit 286, you recognize it for how it was described in the testimony. Mr. Fujimoto, who was one of the two witnesses who had actually seen it, this was just something that had been in a file for years, said it was a pitch materials that Auerdick prepared when he was coming out trying to get hired by Michigan Bulb. And he discussed, as lawyers do, in sort of a pre-PowerPoint presentation, here are a number of promotional law issues you should be concerned about, one of which was Everybody Wins, and the unspoken conclusion to it was the laws could be read, not you are violating. He wasn't even their lawyer at the time. He was attempting to become their lawyer. They could be read to cause you problems, but risk assessment is difficult because, as we heard from Mr. Dirschlag's testimony, unrefuted, interpretation in this area frequently comes through enforcement. It's a give and take with the regulatory agencies.
Right, but I don't want to get away from the clear error versus question of law issue so quickly, because Mr. Anderson's argument is that the district court didn't break this down sufficiently in terms of analytical structure into, number one, fair price, number two, good faith investigation. And had U.S. Trust been made itself fully informed about the sweepstakes risk, its behavior would have been different. But failing to address a legally pertinent point would be a problem of law, not fact.
Yeah, but I think the district court found, as a matter of fact, that this was not a material item, and specifically said, failing to address something that the court has found not to be material can't be evidence of a bad faith process.
But can you do that? Because if you don't know it's even out there, how can you even make an evaluation whether it's material? You as a lawyer would do an investigation of your client's case, and it would be cold comfort to the client that a careless investigation on your part didn't, in the end, hurt it because you got lucky.
The problem is, Your Honor, I think that it's circular. There wasn't an it out there, really. And that's effectively what the district court held as a finding of fact, found as a fact.
Well,
I
think
there was not
a
material event. I'm sorry.
I understand that's your point, but it seems to me, from your point of view, you need to show that whatever U.S. Trust did was enough that it would have uncovered anything material. And because this wasn't material, it didn't uncover it. But, you know, I think you've got to focus on what U.S. Trust itself did.
Certainly. And there was extensive evidence about what U.S. Trust did. And this was a tiny little sliver, the legal piece of it. The big part of what U.S. Trust did, and it did it with its financial advisor, Houlihan Lokey, was to look at the finances, which of course included, as the district court found, an assessment of risks that might impair the finances of the company, that might affect the price, which was one of the significant issues. And the district court praised that, and nobody is challenging what was done there. That was the guts of the due diligence. The Sonnenschein legal review process came towards the end and was designed to turn up significant legal impediments to the transaction, among other things. They documented the transaction. They did what lawyers do. But it was only a confirmatory process, and they did turn up some of the documents in their document request. And the court was a little critical of exactly a piece in the process here, but it did find that the Sonnenschein firm found the documents, and it did find that the documents didn't matter. And therefore said you can't be faulted for not further addressing something that turns out not to be material. But the process did produce enough to be able to assess that, whether you think the firm assessed it correctly. There wasn't any evidence that U.S. Trust was unjustified in relying on Sonnenschein. The court found they were well-qualified. U.S. Trust officer had worked with Sonnenschein before, had experience. They were used to dealing with them in oral communications. The court was critical of that, but expressly noted that that was the industry custom. That was the way it was done, that the trustee could expected to rely on the lawyers to tell them if there were any material legal risks, and it was undisputed and said in the testimony that Sonnenschein never said these are material legal risks. And then, of course,
there was a big debate about the scope of the letter. You know, if somebody had read the letter carefully, they would have seen that it wasn't really talking about all legal risk.
Actually, there wasn't. And the court did say that in its oral ruling, but it's not in the written opinion, and for good reason, because there was no dispute in the evidence. The U.S. Trust officer, Mr. Goldberg, testified very clearly, and we've cited to it in our brief, that he understood what the letter had said. It was one of four Sonnenschein opinions in connection with the transaction, and this one was addressing ERISA and parallel Internal Revenue Code issues, and he knew it wasn't talking about corporate due diligence. And I think Judge Mim, when he got the transcripts finally, had a chance to read that, and that criticism does not appear and would have been clear error given the testimony, that there was no mistake as to what was being communicated.
Well, if the Sonnenschein issue rose to the level of where maybe it didn't meet the good faith standard, if you go to the issue of the fair market value, and then if the fair market value is appropriate, there really isn't a remedy, is there?
That's certainly our position, Your Honor, and we've argued it extensively in the brief that there would have to be some causation of a resulting loss or an illegal profit, which has not ever been in the picture here. U.S. Trust didn't get anything beside its fee. And having failed to prove that there was an overpayment, we think that the case law and the background support that there's no monetary remedy here.
That would be confined then to 1995 as opposed to going forward and when there clearly was a diminishment?
Absolutely. The trust law remedy, and this court and the Supreme Court have said, look to trust law first, is in the case of a breach that's alleged that is proved due to an overpayment, it's the amount of the overpayment, if any, that is the remedy. And that is also the remedy adopted by the Internal Revenue Service and regulations enforcing the exact same provisions which appear both in ERISA, Title I of ERISA, and Title II, which amended the Internal Revenue Code. That's what the IRS puts the excise tax penalty on, is that overpayment, and there is no overpayment here. That's been found and more or less, I think, conceded. But if I could just talk a little more about this Auerdick memo, because so much stress is put on it, and it's not worth everything, besides the fact that it wasn't legal advice. It was, you need a lawyer, and I happen to be that person who has expertise and judgment. As Your Honor's questioning brought out, they hired Mr. Auerdick, and for the next 8 years until he died, they ran every promotion by him twice. He never said anything was illegal. The testimony from everybody who worked with him there was that sometimes he did say, you can't do that, and they didn't do it. But in the gray areas where lawyers frequently practice, how would you read this? What's the significance of this? These broad provisions that are adopted for telemarketers and mobile home operators, second home. He never said do this. In fact, he approved the promotions. And just so I've got it in, also not true about this $4 million. They're trying to find some monetary effect here from the alleged failure to follow what they say was Mr. Auerdick's advice, which it was not, as a matter of fact. This $4 million profit projection was a projection in 1997 of what would happen if they made three sets of changes, of which these changes were just one. Everybody wins. There was a separate set of changes completely unrelated to anything Mr. Auerdick had told them in 1991 involving a settlement with the Attorney General of Michigan. Then there's an issue that's unexplained in the record other than it's a Canadian issue. Michigan Bulb had a Canadian subsidiary and they needed to change some promotion. The combined total of all three of those changes, they said, will be a $4 million hit for half a year, and then we will revert to what had been extreme profitability, way above projections. And in fact, there's testimony in the record from Mr. Ostertag, who was the CEO of Michigan Bulb from 1992 to 95, and the CEO of Foster and Gallagher afterwards, a knowledgeable witness, that if you took that $4 million, besides the pure hindsight piece of this, if you went back to 95 and said, well, you know, in 98 we're going to take a $4 million profit hit, you still would have been above the projections that Foster and Gallagher and Michigan Bulb Management were showing to U.S. Trust. So this was not a big deal. The company's performance, even subtracted $4 million, was better than the company had forecast. And remember that U.S. Trust, unquestioned, lowered those projections. It wasn't willing to accept, not that it disbelieved them, it was being prudent, cautious, and saying, we're not sure. It had already taken risk into account. But even if you had put it all together, this $4 million was something that if somebody could have seen perfectly in 95 what was going to happen, it wouldn't have been material. They'd already taken that risk into account. And it wasn't having anything to do. It was the combination of these factors, not the direct line they're trying to draw from Mr. Auerdick to 1998, unless the court has questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You have 1 minute, sir.
Given the brief time available to me, I'd just like to say a word about remedy and the question regarding causation. With prohibited transactions, it's very clear from the statute and from the cases interpreting it that this is a per se prohibition on these certain transactions, and that having caused the plan to enter into this prohibited transaction, U.S. Trust is responsible for what follows. That's true in the common law of trusts. They were not authorized to enter into this transaction unless and until they conducted a prudent transaction. This transaction was, as the Supreme Court said in the Lockheed case, outside the scope of their lawful authority to enter into. And under the common law of trusts, when that is the case, the participants are entitled to set that transaction aside and recover the purchase price. There are ERISA cases that back that up, and that's the situation. It is undisputed that U.S. Trust's breach. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Continue your thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. U.S. Trust, by causing the ESOP to enter into this prohibited transaction, caused the ESOP to invest its money in stock that subsequently became worthless. That's all the causal link that is required. Thank you.
My thanks to both counsel for excellent briefs in this case on both sides and a very fine oral argument today. The case will be taken under advisement.